Now, secondly, our second topic, the preparations for meditation. These are very important indeed. Sometimes people take up the practice of meditation. It sometimes happens that they're a bit disappointed. They don't seem to be progressing so rapidly as they had thought. They don't exactly see the milestones flashing by or anything like that. They seem to be going rather at a snail's pace. But one of the reasons is that they tend to neglect the preparations. They tend to plunge straight in without prior preparation. But in this context, in this connection, one may say that the preparation is half the battle. If you're really well prepared, you're almost already meditating. To use just an ordinary comparison, one might say it's like cooking. I think the ladies will appreciate this comparison especially. If you get all your vegetables neatly cut and all your spices mixed and all that sort of thing, all your dishes ready, then you'll find that the job is half done. So it's just the same with meditation. The preparation is half the battle. If your preparation is perfect, we may say, you're already meditating without knowing it. So let's look at some of these preparations. First of all, there's what we may call the ethical preparation. This comes first because it's very important indeed. And usually the ethical preparation for meditation is explained in terms of the observance of the five precepts. That is to say, abstention from taking life, from taking what is not given, from sexual misconduct, from wrong speech, and from intoxicants. But this sort of presentation is, I feel, a little bit stereotyped. It falls, as it were, a little too pat. I think we have to go into it a little more deeply. Modern Indian meditation teachers usually speak in terms of controlling three things as constituting the ethical preparation for concentration and meditation. They say one should control, not in the sense of completely eliminating, but of bringing within certain limits, three things. First of all, food. Secondly, sex. And thirdly, sleep. The yogi, they say, should be moderate in these three things. As regards food, of course, one should neither, they say, overload the stomach, nor should one leave it ever completely empty, unless one is doing a definite fast. In fact, the modern Indians very often say that you should divide your stomach, as it were, into four quarters. One quarter you should keep for food. Not a very large allowance. But one quarter you should keep for water. And half you should keep for air. So this is the prescription for the yogi. And it's also said that one should avoid stimulating food. This is said, of course, within the Indian context, where they're fond, in fact very fond, inordinately fond, of spices and all sorts of hot things, red pepper and so on. So the yogi is advised to abstain from these stimulating foods and spices and so on. They say that stimulating food stimulates thoughts and even stimulates passions. I regard this with some skepticism, but I have noticed that there is one factor which is perhaps relevant with regard to stimulating food in the form of spices and chilies and so on, that if you eat a very highly spiced diet, and this is very relevant in India indeed, where people, as I say, take lots of spices, you will very often suffer from flatulence, that is to say, from wind. And this will very often disturb you at the time of your meditation. I do know that I have meditated with Indians who take so many spices and so much of the hot stuff that you can hear the rumblings in their intestines, I was even hundreds of yards away. It can be really deafening at times. So I think this particular prescription is made more with this in mind. As I say, I'm a little skeptical about this idea of food being stimulating in a purely psychological sense. Then as regards control of sex, here it is said, of course, that best of all is celibacy, but if this is difficult or impossible for any reason, then here also moderation should be observed. In the course of meditation, we do require, we do need a great deal of nervous energy, as we shall find if we get very deeply into meditation. And this nervous energy is dissipated in the course of sexual indulgence. And therefore, in this matter also, we're advised the meditator, especially those who are in retreat, should observe very strict restraint and moderation. Here we can say that with a little observation, with a little reflection, each person will know for himself or herself what is best in this respect. Then sleep. This is not something that we usually speak about in connection with meditation, but this too is important, and we're told by the Indian meditation teachers that sleep should be just a little less than what we used to take before we started meditation. If we meditate much, in fact, we do find that sleep tends automatically to be reduced. You need less sleep. Now, sleep, we may say, very broadly speaking, or in a general way, is a very wonderful thing indeed. We usually take it for granted, but it's not only a very wonderful thing, sleep is a very mysterious thing. I remember in Don Quixote, Cervantes sings the praises of sleep, and it's a very beautiful and striking passage, but we should reflect upon this whole matter. It's only recently, it's only in the course of the last few years, that we've begun to understand what sleep really is, and what sleep is for. Formerly we used to think that you slept just to rest your body and rest your heart and rest your everything else, but apparently it isn't just like that. It seems that we have to sleep, at least partially, in order to be able to dream. And dreams, it seems, are necessary so that all the perceptions and impressions of the day can be sorted out and filed away neatly for future reference. In fact, in this respect, man's mind has been compared to a computer. And I'm told that the computer needs resting sometimes. And I believe that there are people who go around putting computers to sleep, as it were, so that they've got time to sort out all the data which has been fed into them and process it properly and file it away for reference. If the computer isn't given this period of rest, it just gets jammed up. It goes crazy, as it were, or at least neurotic. So we require sleep in order to be able to dream, and we require dreams, apparently, this may be only part of the truth, so that we can sort out the vast mass, all these millions and millions of impressions which have become surging in on us all during the day. Now, if we meditate deeply, we're no longer aware of the body. We're no longer aware of impressions. Impressions don't register. So there's much less sorting out and filing away to be done. Therefore, we don't need to dream so much. Therefore, we don't need to sleep so much. So this is why, or at least part of the reason why, when we meditate a lot, when we meditate deeply, so as to be unconscious of the body, we need less sleep. And those who do meditate a lot will find that their sleep is quite drastically reduced. I'm quite sure there are two or three people here at least who've had the experience of cutting down sleep as a result of meditating to 2 or 3 hours or even less per night, and not feeling any strain or any tiredness or any weariness at all. But this is just by the way. What is of importance here is to emphasize the fact that the meditator should bring sleep under control. Not think that it can be left out, not think that it doesn't matter, that you can go on sleeping and do your meditation afterwards. No. Just as in the case of food and sex, so sleep also must be controlled.